Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Unexpected Elements is the podcast exploring the science behind the headlines.
It's a real melting pot.
Yeah, there certainly is a lot happening.
Unexpected Elements from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Gareth Barlow, and at 1300 GMT on Thursday the 14th of September, these are our main stories. Thousands of people are feared dead after catastrophic floods in Libya. Now the UN says it's sending an aid. Tremors are still being felt in Morocco days after a massive deadly quake that are hampering search and rescue efforts. And a new case of alleged sexual harassment caught on camera shocks Spanish society. Also in this podcast, we look at the most unlikely of royal weddings and...
We need to see pain in the economy. We need to remind people that they work for the employer, not the other way around. It's a dynamic that has to change. We've got to kill that attitude, and that has to come through hurting the economy.
Hear why one multimillionaire is now rowing back on his comments about workers. 4 days on from the cataclysmic floods in eastern Libya, and the number of people feared to have died is in the thousands. Many bodies have still not been found. The worst affected area is the port city of Derna, which was home to around 90,000 people. Following the storm, two dams burst, sweeping whole communities into the sea. The BBC's Joan Wood has this report on how the people of Derna are trying to come to terms with the scale of the disaster.
Climbing over the rubble that used to be the city of Derna, a Red Crescent worker prepares a body bag. Wrapped in a blanket, four men carry a tiny body, one of the many thousands of victims of this disaster. For the boy's father, it is too much. God give me patience. My heart is with you, the man says to his son. The scale of what happened in Libya last Sunday is hard to comprehend. You can hear the fear in their voices and the power of the water. Shortly after this video was taken, thousands of people were simply washed into the Mediterranean.
No picture, no film can ever describe what we've seen.
Salah drove from the city of Benghazi to find his relatives, only to discover 150 of them had died.
Hundreds of bodies laid on the street, on the what is used to be streets. The whole buildings were out. It's not there, as if it's never been there, never. 150 in one family, all of them wiped out. Grandparents, grandmothers, wives, kids, all. All of them, they were thrown into the sea.
The initial shock is now turning to anger. This was a natural disaster, but enabled by the failings of government and of the dams that should have held the water back. Abu al-Mantasa lived in the city.
We had warned the authorities since last week, no, for years, that the dam had cracks and needs to be maintained. We said it and nobody listened to us. And now the whole of Derna is flooded.
All the while, an increasingly forlorn rescue operation continues. As the firemen cut their way into a garage, a medic waits outside with an orange stretcher. Whoever took shelter inside did not survive. Like the little boy, like so many others, they too leave in a black body bag. This is partly a story about the force of nature, but it's also one about the failings of government and the terrible consequences when the two collide.
Well, you heard there in Joe Inwood's report the anger towards local authorities for not heeding warnings about the instability of the dams. Many see this as a symptom of the country split between two rival administrations. one based in the capital Tripoli in the west and the other in Tobruk in the east, and in between them, rival militias that compete for influence. In response to the floods, the United Nations has said it's sending all the aid and teams to the region it possibly can. But are the rival factions cooperating in the relief effort? Our correspondent Lena Sinjab is monitoring the situation from Beirut.
So far, we've heard announcements from both sides that this is a national catastrophe. It's a national disaster that they have to attend to. We've heard reports of them coordinating efforts and talking to each other, and both of them calling for international aid to arrive. This is the time to set differences aside and act for the sake of the nation. This is a country that is oil rich, but poor with administration, poor with how these two governments are delivering for their own nationals. Now, the situation in eastern Libya, especially in Derna, is beyond catastrophic. The need for efforts for rescue is immense, and it will take weeks and probably months before this city goes back on its feet. But the priority now is to retrieve and recover bodies. There are fears of disease spreading because of the corpses covered with rubble, but there are also concerns of efforts of finding these bodies. We've heard reports of people losing entire families, and the number of the dead is only going to be higher as the hours and the days unfold the rescue operation.
Lena Sinjab. The flooding in Libya isn't the only natural disaster North Africa is having to cope with this week. Almost 3,000 people died in the earthquake in Morocco, and many have been left homeless. Smaller quakes are still being felt in the Atlas Mountains, where there's little hope of finding survivors. The BBC's James Copnell is there and sent this report from the town of Amsmes.
The clatter of a busy kitchen. Lunch is well on the way. But most of the people eating here at the Oliverie Hotel are not paying guests. Instead, they lost their homes in the earthquake. Saladin, whose family owns the hotel, has opened up its doors to everyone who needs it.
We stop all activities and we open our doors to everyone. Everyone is welcomed here. Everyone who have no place to stay, here is his house.
What needs to happen next? Just tell us, explain to us what needs to be done to get this place back to normal.
Rebuild the houses, rebuild the town. Because right now they have tents, but there are places that aren't safe. People here can't leave their land because people here are really attached to their land.
A walk around one of Amziz's oldest neighbourhoods, the Mela, gives an idea of the scale of the problem. There's a heavily damaged pink mosque to my left, a school with no roof, a shop with its entrails open to the world, a shoe hanging up rather forlornly from a shelf. There are possessions, beds and fridges out in the open. Homes have been destroyed. So just how easy is it going to be to rebuild this town? Back at the hotel, they're asking themselves just that question. Shaima, a university student, used to live in a nice home nearby. Now she's homeless and wondering about her future. So what's going to happen now for you, do you think?
We don't know. We're going to stay on the street until we figure out where we're going to go. Because even if we go to Marrakech, it's still risky because the earth are still moving.
Not safe.
It's not safe for us.
Are you confident that the government is going to be able to help you?
I don't know. I think it's hard for them because there is a lot of cities. Maybe the government can help, maybe not. I don't have trust in them, really. I don't trust them. I trust people in Morocco, other people in Morocco. I hope they can help us because if the government can do anything in these cases, it's a disaster.
A couple of kids kick a ball around on the lawn. They should be in school. It's not hard to worry about what comes next for them.
If I view it as a child, I would be very happy because I would not be obliged to wake up early, to have homework, to go to school.
This is Abdel Ali Mahoudi, a secondary school teacher.
If I view it from another perspective of a parent and of a teacher, this is going to be a great, great loss for our future generations.
When you look at all these challenges, what's the one that worries you the most?
You know, you can die of cold in few hours. And we are about to welcome winter time, where temperatures are below zero in the village and the mountains are covered with snow. So How can you imagine the situation of all people that are now homeless, that are now sitting under tents? How could they manage that cold if their houses are not built again? We can stand hunger, we can stand thirst, but we can't stand cold.
From Morocco's Atlas Mountains, that report by James Copnell. Many women in Spain were hoping that men would start to show them more respect after Luis Rubiales was forced to resign as president of the country's football association. There was a national outcry when he kissed the World Cup-winning player Jenny Hermoso on the lips. But sexual harassment is in the headlines again after a man in the street appeared to grope the backside of a television reporter live on air. He reaches behind Isa Balado as she speaks to the presenter in the studio.
Que tengo a mi espalda el hombre intentó entrar armado. Un segundo, que estamos en directo. Disculpad, el hombre intentó entrar armado en esta.
The man has been arrested on suspicion of sexual assault. Guy Hedgeco is our correspondent in Madrid.
This clip has gone viral on social media under the hashtag Se Acabó. That's the slogan that emerged from the affair surrounding Luis Rubiales after he kissed Jenny Hermoso on the mouth after the World Cup final. And that was seen as a sort of slogan against sexism in general across Spain. But there's also been a reaction to this from the very highest level. Yolanda Díaz, who is one of the deputy prime ministers, she spoke out about this. And she says sexism makes journalists suffer sexual assaults like this. Her colleague Irene Montero, who is Minister of Equality, also talked about it. She said this was non-consensual physical contact. Therefore, it was sexual violence. So, yeah, people are talking about it, whether it's in the government or online as well.
I'm just watching the clip as we're talking here, Guy. You can see that the reporter remains fairly calm before he walks away trying to scrunch her hair again. And she's been praised for remaining calm. But many are saying that everyday sexism in Spain and playing down these kind of incidents has to end.
Well, yes, I mean, that's part of this debate that has sort of been going on certainly since the Luis Rubiales case, but really before that as well. And issues of consent, sexual consent and sexual equality have been very much in the public domain over the last few years in particular. And that's partly because this government has focused a lot on that in terms of legislation. But there is a feeling that there's still a lot of resistance to that. The police, for example, are concerned about a rise in sexual assaults on women among young people over recent years. And then on a sort of everyday level, when it comes to offices or just day-to-day life, a lot of women say they still suffer sexism. They say there are too many people behaving in this way who go unpunished.
The BBC's Guy Hedgeco. The BBC's learnt that in the last year, a Russian fighter pilot attempted to shoot down a British surveillance aircraft that was carrying dozens of military personnel. Russia blamed the incident, which occurred over the Black Sea, on a technical malfunction. The UK's Ministry of Defence accepted that explanation, but as our correspondent Jonathan Beale reports, the MOD knew much more.
The RAF plane was on a surveillance mission over the Black Sea with a crew of up to 30. It was able to intercept communications and hear the actions of a rogue Russian pilot that could have led to their deaths. An ambiguous order from a Russian ground station was interpreted by one of two Russian pilots as permission to fire. He released a missile, but it missed. Senior Western defence sources have confirmed to the BBC that a row then broke out with his wingmen, who did not believe they had permission to fire. The rogue pilot still released a second missile. That one simply fell from the wing. While US defence officials later described the incident as a near shootdown and very scary, the UK Ministry of Defence accepted Russia's explanation of a malfunction, not wanting to reveal details of its intelligence gathering or escalate the situation.
Jonathan Beale. The announcement of a rather unconventional marriage is currently the talk of social media as Princess Märtha Louise of Norway, the eldest child of the king, has set a wedding date for her union to an American, Derek Verrett, a self-professed shaman and spiritual guru to the stars. Our very own Gossip Girl, Stephanie Prentice, has been filling me in.
This couple have been the subject of scrutiny in Norway for a while, but the announcement of the details of their wedding, it's made them more famous on the wider internet, where shamans are often subjected to a level of ridicule from some corners. So there's been a lot of discussion about this and no small amount of memes. Now, this Ferrari is reminiscent of when the pair toured Norway back in 2019. That was under the brand The Princess and the Shaman. They undeniably did create waves. They discussed alternative beliefs, which included being able to communicate with angels, in fact, a broad range of spirits, a belief in ancient medicine, including using medallions to ward off dark energies, and also a discussion around using spells. There's also been some more controversial claims from Mr. Verrett in the past. He suggested that cancer could be a choice and that medallions could ward off COVID-19. He, in fact, sold some online for more than $200 each. He's also reported claiming that he predicted 9/11 about 2 years before it happened.
Despite some of those unconventional claims and conventions, the royal family in Norway have given their blessing to this marriage, haven't they?
They have indeed. We know Princess Märtha Louise has stepped back from her royal duties in the past few years, but she seems connected still to the royal family. Her father has given the union his blessing. In a new statement, he congratulated the pair. He said that he was delighted about the upcoming wedding and that he was happy to welcome Mr. Verrett into his family.
That was Stephanie Prentice. Still to come.
Puffs are colourful. They were talking about it on TikTok. So I thought, why not? And that's why I started.
Why French lawmakers may soon be saying no to vapes.
We do our best to save time, save room, save our breath, and save for a rainy day. Or at least, we try to. But at Énergir, we believe first and foremost in saving energy. That's why, for the last 20 years, we've completed more than 130,000 energy-efficient projects to help our clients consume less and better every day. So why do we want to sell less of what we have to offer? Because everyone profits from saving energy. Énergir. Imagine energy differently.
Heat waves, floods, droughts, wildfires.
Catastrophic consequences from climate change.
What's going on? Is this real?
The Climate Question is the podcast exploring our planet's changing environment and what we're doing across the world to adapt and respond to it.
The futures ahead of us are very sensitive to the choices that we make today.
If we don't start fixing it, we're going to be victims of it.
Get engaged.
The Climate Question from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast. Let's take you to Vietnam now, because in the capital, Hanoi, yesterday, deep in a maze of streets, a fire broke out at a small apartment building. The flames blocked the only exit and fire trucks couldn't reach the site due to narrow roads. 56 people died. Today, the government's ordered a nationwide safety check on similar buildings to prevent another disaster. For more on this, I spoke to our Asia-Pacific regional editor, Celia Hatton.
Well, it really is striking, Gareth, to see what's happening in Vietnam in response to this fire. You know, it's a country of almost 100 million people, and the strength of attention that's been focused on the inhabitants of that one building, very narrow, tall apartment building in the center of Hanoi, where 150 people were really packed into 9 floors. And there are many people now asking why so many died in such a short period of time, because it only took the firefighters an hour to put out the fire once they reached the spot. But that was really the challenge, getting through narrow alleyways, getting their supplies there in order to put the fire out. And also the design of the building, because it had a really narrow staircase going up through the middle, which was the only way that people could travel through the building. And it acted as a funnel. The fire started in the very bottom of the building and sent flames and smoke right up through the middle. People were really trapped inside their apartments because there were bars on all the windows, and they really were meant to keep thieves out, but they trapped people inside. They acted like cages. And so there are some heartwarming stories of parents who grabbed small children and literally leaped from one building onto the roof of another to save their children, and they survived. But there are so many who didn't, and that's why there's really nationwide grief across Vietnam today.
Considering how deadly this incident is, considering how many elements came together to make the situation even worse than it maybe could have been, what's being done to prevent more cases like this?
Well, the irony is that Vietnam actually has quite strict fire safety regulations, but they're only really being applied to new buildings. And so we have a lot of multinational companies complaining that they can't get their new factories approved because the fire safety just isn't up to scratch. However, there's so many, many poor people who live in these so-called tube buildings, very tall, thin buildings with only one entrance and exit. And that's really where questions are being raised today. So fire safety chiefs have been ordered to check every single apartment building in the country. They're talking about fire safety education, you know, making sure there are exits available to all buildings. But really the concern today is the contrast between rich people who live in typically newer fire-checked buildings and poor people who don't.
Celia Hatton. Now to a somewhat unlikely clash, as officials in Taiwan have hit back at the billionaire businessman Elon Musk after he suggested the country was an integral part of China. Using the X platform, formerly Twitter, that's owned by Mr. Musk, Taiwan's foreign minister wrote, "Listen up, Taiwan is not part of the PRC and certainly not for sale." The spat plays into broader tensions brewing in the region. I spoke to our China media analyst, Kerry Allen.
He made these comments at the All In Summit in Los Angeles, which was earlier this week. It's a 3-day summit, and it covers speakers at this event cover a range of topics. And Musk was also talking about Ukraine, AI, the creator economy. And China was a big talking point because Musk was only in China in June. He has business in the country as part of his work with Tesla. And he did say at this event that he thinks he understands China well. He's met with officials and yes, he's got factories in Shanghai. But yeah, he commented that he felt that Taiwan was similar to Hawaii, and this really didn't go down well. It led to Taiwan's foreign minister, Joseph Wu, saying, "Listen up, Taiwan is not a part of the People's Republic of China, and it's certainly not for sale." And this has been a big talking point today on X, the platform formerly known as Twitter, that obviously Mr. Musk owns. With both sides, people from state media in China applauding him for saying this, and people from Taiwan very, very critical of it.
Because it's worth remembering, isn't it, Kerry, that Taiwan's democratically elected government strongly rejects any sovereignty claim by Beijing, by China, but that China has vowed to take back control of Taiwan, and if it requires force, then so be it.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, Taiwan is an island that has, for all practical purposes, been independent since 1950. But China sees this, the Beijing government sees this as a rebel region that must be reunited with the mainland by force if necessary. And it has been the case that Beijing has been increasing pressure on Taiwan through various means, economic, diplomatic, military. And only this week, Taiwan has seen large-scale Chinese military activity round the island. It is a particularly tense time and not a very good time for Musk to be making a comment as politically tense as this.
Kerry Allen, an Australian multimillionaire, has apologised after some very divisive comments that have been viewed on TikTok more than 11 million times. Let's hear a bit of what Tim Gurner had to say.
People decided that they didn't really want to work so much anymore through COVID, and that has had a massive issue on productivity. You know, tradies have definitely pulled back on productivity. You know, they have been paid a lot to do not too much in the last few years, and we need to see that change. We need to see unemployment rise. Unemployment has to jump 40-50%, in my view. We need to see pain in the economy. We need to remind people that they work for the employer, not the other way around. It's a dynamic that has to change. We've got to kill that attitude, and that has to come through hurting the economy, which is what the whole global, you know, the world is trying to do. The governments around the world are trying to increase unemployment to get that to some sort of normality.
Well, before Mr. Gurner's apology, our business correspondent Katie Silver gave me her take on his comments.
Post-COVID, there's been a huge shortage of workers. I remember I was in Australia at the start of last year, and I remember just you couldn't go past a shop without urgent demands for workers. So in that sense, there's perhaps some merit there. The power dynamic has changed. Whether or not we therefore need to see unemployment and economic hurt. Australia actually has had a pretty successful go at reducing their inflation despite maintaining a relatively strong level of employment. So I don't necessarily think there's merit there, but it does go back to that wider issue that we're talking about time and time again about how the COVID pandemic has changed the feelings for many workers, their employees' attitude, and whether or not they put work first, or, you know, that kind of rise of terms like quiet quitting and the way many people now feel about their jobs post the pandemic.
So considering then that societal shift that you talk about there, how does that then mean people are viewing his comments today?
Oh, they've been hugely criticised. Like in Australia, to give you an idea, from both sides of the politics, one Labor MP said they were the sort of comments you'd associate with a cartoon villain. Another one from the other side of politics, the Liberal Party, said that he could not be more out of touch and that the loss of a job is not a number. It's these people on the streets and dependent on food banks. So it's certainly really divisive, really annoyed people. And the fact that he's now worth about $600 million, he's previously spoken, for example, about how he received a leg up from loans from his grandfather. And so that sort of discourse and that kind of concept of family generational wealth certainly doesn't play in well when it's all combined.
No, and briefly, it's been noted, hasn't it, that the disparity between CEO wealth and worker wealth is at the greatest ever extent now.
That's right. Those comments were made by the US Congresswoman Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez. So criticism's even going as far as the United States. And that's because we are seeing as well with this cost of living crisis, it's hitting poor people harder. And therefore, these sorts of comments couldn't really seem more, as one of those Labor MPs said, more tone deaf in the current context of the current cost of living crisis.
Well, in his apology, Mr. Gerner said his comments had been deeply insensitive to employees, tradespeople and families across Australia who are affected by cost of living pressures and job losses. In France, a ban on disposable e-cigarettes, known there as puffs, is expected to come into force by the end of the year. Anti-smoking campaigners say children are being targeted to draw them into taking up the habit for life. Several other countries in Europe, including Germany, Belgium and Ireland, have announced similar bans, and Britain's also said to be considering one. Our correspondent in Paris, Hugh Schofield, sent this report.
So for those of you who haven't seen one of these things, what I've just bought there is an Elf Bar 600, lime green in colour, pomme pêche, that's apple peach in flavour. There's a sign saying bar to under 18-year-olds, and it's made, it says, by the iMiracle technology company of Shenzhen, China. And when I open it up, you get out a kind of capsule wrapped up nicely in a kind, a bit like a sort of medium length, medium thickness cigar in lime green with a kind of lip attachment down one end.
Pomme glacée, pastèque fraise, on a la pastèque tout court, du fruit du dragon. On a aussi.
But it's not me or the likes of me that's the main target of the makers of puffs. It's young people, the kind who are watching influencers like this on social media as they sing the praises of the different flavors, chocolate and hazelnut, watermelon, marshmallow. Little wonder that according to the figures presented by opponents, some 13% of children aged between 13 and 16 have tried disposable vapes at least once. One of them, Sam, I met on the street near his school in Paris.
Puffs are colourful, and in my head, they're not as dangerous as cigarettes. The flavours are aimed at children, and they're nice. My favourites are ice grape and apricots. It was about 2 years ago, they were talking about it on TikTok. It was kind of a trend, so I thought, why not? And that's why I started.
The French government's concerned by two sets of figures, one that shows smoking in general picking up again, and the other that use of e-cigarettes of all kinds among young people tripled in the last 5 years. They're worried there's a connection.
Bienvenue dans Focus Dimanche. Je suis très heureux de vous retrouver pour cette première émission de la saison.
So last week, Prime Minister Elisabeth Borne appeared on the radio to make the announcement.
On présentera prochainement.
We'll soon be presenting our new anti-smoking plan, and one of its key elements will be a ban on disposable e-cigarettes, these famous puffs which cause such bad habits among our young people. You may say there is no nicotine in them, but what they do is create a reflex. Children get used to it and end up being drawn to tobacco.
That packet I bought at the beginning cost me €9.50. That's less than a packet of cigarettes. And with 600 puffs advertised, it's the equivalent in puffs of two packets. And don't forget that while some disposable vapes are nicotine-free, most, like this one, are not. This is me finally trying out the Elf Bar 600. It's like smoking sweets. Horrible, but I imagine for children, very, very Moorish.
The BBC's Hugh Schofield. We end this Global News podcast in Australia, where the palm cockatoo is known for being unique in the animal kingdom for using bits of wood as drumsticks to tap out rhythmic beats. As arguably, with humans, it all forms part of a complex ritual to try and attract a mate. Now, scientists from the Australian National University have released a research paper with more details about the parrot's romantic schemes. Professor Robert Heinschen was part of the study.
So they have a really elaborate sort of display which involves combinations of 30 different call types. The males erect their very impressive crests, reach for the sky with their crests, and they dance and they bob and they twirl on the branch. And then, as if that isn't enough, at the end of all of that, the male will sort of waddle out to the end of the branch and he'll sniff off a stick or a seed pod and he'll spend some time fashioning that into a sound tool. And he'll start tapping rhythmically against the side of the hollow. Every male has his own drumming signature. And now we find that the style of their drumsticks differs as well. And they're making different shapes and sizes of their drumsticks. And making the stick seems to be part of the display because the females are watching their every move. And the males are actually showing off by, you know, how thick a stick they can cut off with their powerful bills. And then they're whittling it down to the size and shape that they like. And the females are just a couple of meters away, just watching really intently their every move.
Well, it would be remiss not to give a drumming palm cockatoo a moment in the spotlight here on the Global News podcast. So take a listen, see what you think. Personally, I think it sounds like mild construction work, but I'll leave you to have your own opinion. If you do want to share your opinion, then drop us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Pat Sissons. The producer was David Lewis. The editor, Karen Martin. I'm Gareth Barlow. Until next time, goodbye.